to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. One of the bright spots for progressives in our country today is mayors. Mayors are remarkably free of partisan warfare. There are no Republican or Democratic potholes. Mayors have executive power to get things done, and they use it to solve problems every day. Here with us today is one of the best mayors in the country, the mayor of Santa Barbara, California, Helene Schneider. First elected to the city council in 2003, she ran for mayor in 2010 and won. After doing important work in Santa Barbara, she is now running for the United States Congress. Following Mayor Schneider will be an interview with Ralph Nader. Mayor Helene Schneider, welcome to All Together Now.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
So do you feel like you're representing the most beautiful district in America?
Well, absolutely. California's District 24 is not just the city of Santa Barbara. It's actually quite large. It's all of Santa Barbara County and north up through San Luis Obispo County, and a huge coastline area, beautiful vineyards, lots of agriculture, the San Ynez Mountains, the Channel Islands National Park. It's pretty spectacular here. Plus, it's in the 70s today, too, so the weather is pretty awesome in February.
You're making us all jealous here with our 30-degree weather.
It does. We are in the middle of a drought, so if you do have to be in a drought, let it be beautiful. We could use some rain, but it is a pretty spectacular place.
Very good. Now, before running for office, you were in human resource management, primarily for Planned Parenthood. What made you decide to run for office?
To run for local office, I was involved even while working at Planned Parenthood in my volunteer capacity for local organizations. We have a local Santa Barbara Women's Political Committee dedicated to electing feminists and women into public office, and got involved on issues related to affordable housing and helping people in who underrepresented groups and dealing with just basic municipal affairs. I got on the City Housing Authority Commission and, looked at the federal policies that relate to local government, and then a seat opened up in City Hall and went for it. And, really since then, being able to combine the experience that I had at Planned Parenthood, focusing on access for women and their families to make decisions about their health care without government interference, and as a mayor focusing on getting a variety of things done, working across a diverse political spectrum and with my colleagues, I really want to take that perspective to Washington, D.C., and see what we can do to deal with the gridlock there and focus on getting things done, important national issues.
Well, I'm so glad you ran for the city council and then for mayor and now running for Congress, because we need more progressive women like you in there making decisions for us. So thank you for doing that. You've talked about governing with a gender lens. What does it mean to you to govern with a gender lens?
So I think especially when it comes to local government, people generally think of what does a city do? We focus on public safety and police and fire services, on public works, on streets and roads and parks. But you also have to look at what does that really mean? And for example, when it comes to our police department, it's of course when you want to dial 911, you have help on the way right away. But also, what do we do to try to stem hate crimes from happening, or the training involved with our police officers, making sure that our police force and fire force represent the community in terms of gender equity and diversity. When it comes to public works, it's not just about fixing the potholes. It's about safe routes to school and getting people from point A to point B if they don't have a car with public transportation. Or when it deals with parks and recreation, it's looking at what are the opportunities for kids after school or for senior programs. Working women and families maybe who may be in a sandwich generation, taking care of both kids and seniors, getting them access to programs so that they can then reach their full potential. So taking that gender lens, meaning looking at how does this relate to the day-to-day lives of women and their families on every level of government, is one way to help focus your priorities in your budget and really enhance the quality of life for everyone involved.
I think that's really well said. And one of the things I love about your approach to governance is that you look at it not like there's a, just kind of a finite set of women's issues that we need to deal with, but really kind of looking more broadly at every aspect of governing with a gender lens, like how does this affect the women in our community and what can we do to make life better and maybe level the playing field for the women?
Well, exactly. And when we do that, I believe the whole community benefits. When women are, in particular, are able to meet both their career and family goals, that helps the entire family, which then helps the community. When women are able to have access to career opportunities in city government and leadership roles, they bring their perspective with them when it comes to making policy decisions. So things like street lighting, you know, can lend to where are areas where there might be hot spots and crime areas that that particularly affect dealing with violence against women and combating that. So looking at it from that angle can help coordinate the work that we do every day, but I think enhance it in terms of the quality of life for everyone else.
You're exactly right. And we had two guests on from Iceland very recently on this show, and one of them, her job in Iceland was the gender budgeting. I mean, you mentioned about looking at the budget and how does that impact the women. I was astonished to realize that's actually a career and a position in the Icelandic government, is to look at the budget with the gender lens. And she's now living in Texas. So if you or any of our listeners would find that helpful at some point, that's a whole body of knowledge and experience now in governance is gender budgeting.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So you mentioned about stopping violence against women, and you've been mayor now for, 5 years?
Seventh year as mayor. So, yeah.
Seventh year as mayor.
Towards the second half of my second term.
Okay, great. So what have you been able to do as mayor with respect to stopping violence against women in your community?
Yeah. Well, basic public safety is paramount, obviously, for every mayor in every city. And it's not only dealing with training with our police force, but it's things like coordinating with our local rape crisis center and the DA's office so that when there is a crime of sexual assault or rape, that the survivor is also able to help to navigate the criminal justice system in a way that respects her and tries to minimize the impact of going through that process after such a crime is committed against her. Those kind of things. And focusing on connecting with our schools and making sure there's safe routes to school and that at night when there's after school programs and working with families who have kids who may be in at-risk situations and reducing that risky behavior, then giving them other healthy alternatives to create better choices in their lives. Looking through just general ways of getting around town in a way that's safer. That's been a big piece too. And we actually give a lot of grants to local nonprofit organizations like Shelter Services for Women and the Rape Crisis Center and other basic shelter and housing options to help reduce the level of crimes against women in particular.
And have you seen much of an impact from those efforts? Can you tell if it mattered?
Absolutely. We hear every year when we give out grants, we need to follow up to make sure and measure the impact of those dollars that go to the organizations, and have found that the coordination of efforts have really led to not only lower crime rates here, but if and when a crime does happen, of getting someone to justice sooner and helping the victims of the crime easier and faster. Another issue I think also has to do with dealing with poverty and homelessness in our community, and that coordination of efforts to help women get off the streets, which can be very dangerous for them, and into supportive housing services is a huge part of what we do here as a city, even though we're not the ones that have the public health department or the the mental health department or social services. We are able to coordinate with all the stakeholders involved to help women in particular get off the streets and into supportive housing, especially, too, if they have kids.
Absolutely, and I want to talk in a minute some more about the issue of homelessness, but staying with the violence against women for a minute, you were one of the stars in the show when I organized a forum for mayors on governing with a gender lens in San Francisco last year. You did a totally awesome job, very inspiring. And one of the issues that came up when we had that mayor's roundtable about women was the idea that to stop violence against women, one of the things we need to do is to train police to deal with women as victims and not as criminals. Is that something that you've worked with your police force, or how does that work in Santa Barbara?
Right, and I think here and elsewhere we're focusing, for example, on the issue of trafficking, and when women are put in a situation where they are forced into prostitution services and law enforcement, is part of an enforcement activity, the women involved in that, we try to help them get out of that situation by really looking at the people who are responsible in women trafficking and reducing that. And so not criminalizing that activity because they are actually forced into a situation that is harming them as well as, the women around them. So that has been something, again, it's a different perspective of how to treat a crime when something's in place is going to the source of why that crime is happening. And that also has to do with how you train your officers, making sure you have as much gender equity as possible in your sworn police officers, and understanding what it means to go through the criminal justice system and making those connections between law enforcement and the court system. So that is something I know our county has been working on with the district attorney's office and the court system, and I think making a big difference in helping reduce the level of trafficking that does exist.
That's great. And have you found the police cooperative or resistant, or how hard was it to be training the police to deal with women as victims and not criminals?
Oh, well, the city of Santa Barbara's had a long history of focusing on community policing and focusing on what is the core roots of violence where it happens. And so obviously, if you go to the source of the problem, that's going to reduce the problem in a bigger way than just deal with the symptoms of it. And so
right.
There was very, very well received, and actually some great police work being done in trying to get to the root of the problem.
Excellent. And you're so right about showing the connection between poverty and homelessness and then the violence against women. Women who are on the street are obviously going to be more vulnerable. And in some ways, you got your first position in public office was when a former mayor appointed you as commissioner for the Housing Authority, and you've continued your interest and work in that area as the co-chair of the Housing and Homelessness Task Force for the U.S. Conference of Mayors nationwide. So can you tell our listeners, why do you care about housing and what have you been able to do about it as mayor?
Well, thanks for that. This has obviously been an issue of great importance around the country. And I think when people think of Santa Barbara, they think of the more glitzy part of it. And there are people of great resources who live here, but there's also a big segment of people who live in poverty. And housing is very expensive in this part of the country. And people, some the cracks plus and we found nationally there have been studies that when you're able to coordinate housing with services, whatever that may be, whether it's connected to the Veterans Administration if you're a vet, or disability insurance, or mental health services, or helping people who may be addicted to drugs and alcohol to those services, really wrap around services around someone, it actually costs less to help to house them in a safe place, give the services to them, then what you end up seeing otherwise, which is this revolving door of people living on the streets, going into the emergency room, back on the streets, maybe going to jail, going through the court system. The cost, the public cost of that is many times more than actually solving the problem. And as a city, even though we don't have full jurisdiction over a lot of those organizations and services, we provide the political will and the structure to help connect the dots. And actually now looking at measuring our results so that we can work with the federal government on the not only the funding options but the rules about counting how many homeless people are in our community and what does it take to get them into housing and figuring out the programs that work and putting your resources there. That's a huge part that I've learned from other mayors around the country of finding best practices. The First Lady and her initiative to initiate the Mayor's Challenge to end veteran homelessness has been tremendous, and it helps not only veterans but helps the whole system in place become more efficient. And we have found that as long as you can make those connections, you can really get level when those programs or services or funding gets threatened by Congress in the budget, you can see the direct effect. And we know when mayors get together and really focus on the importance of those federally funded programs, we can make sure that it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or Democrat, you can see the bigger picture, and then Congress listens and responds appropriately.
Right, and also, mayors, you're right there with we the people. You're meeting us in the supermarket and walking on the streets. There's, you know, certain level of accountability and interaction that you have that some of the other elected officials miss. So, good for you for doing that. And what have you been able to do in Santa Barbara in the housing? Do you feel like you've made significant progress on housing? I mean, through this kind of coordinated approach, it seems like that would be a very effective way to address the problem.
Right. And first off, as the city working or local city housing authority that gets national awards on their programs, you know, a significant portion of the housing units in the city are affordable subsidized units, and so coordinating and having a space for people to go is really very important. The last few years, as a collaborative have been put together throughout the county, and a policy council, of which I serve on the board, works on how do you better connect those dots and where are those gaps in services or gaps in connectivity. And there was a great project we had in one part of town where the businesses, social service agencies, our law enforcement, the county, the city, we looked at the top 10 most chronic homeless people. What is exactly each of those individuals? What do they each need in order to get them off the street? And it took a while and it took a lot of effort, but after a year, all 10 of them are now off the street and into some form of housing or reconnected with their families. So not only is that helping their own personal lives, but then the impacts that chronic homelessness has on a community also is reduced. And we found that, you know, other people aren't taking over those spots. So it's really an intensive way of focusing on what's needed person by person by person. But if you look at it long term, it's more cost effective and more effective in general in terms of making sure people stay housed with whatever services they need and hopefully, you know, get back into the workforce and reconnect with their friends and family in a very healthy way.
Very good. Congratulations on making progress in that really important area. And I know the work you've done in Santa Barbara has helped to inspire and guide mayors across the country. So thank you for that. What would you say are some of the other key accomplishments you've been able to make in your community as mayor?
Well, I think that, you know, it's been really interesting that my first term as mayor was when the financial crisis hit. And we have a council of seven that's very politically diverse, and we had to figure out how to cut a third of our operating budget because of the financial recession. And working with our through collective bargaining with our with seven union groups as well as our staff, we were able to keep the essential functions going and still pass a budget unanimously every year without sending people to the unemployment line. It was tough. There were furloughs. There were services that had to be cut or reduced significantly. But we did it in a way that we didn't get ready. And so that was really very important. Now getting into the second term, I'd say we went from a financial drought to an actual drought, and dealing with the situation of water here in our in California has been really quite severe. It's the most significant extraordinary drought this state has ever seen. And working with our community, in not only in terms of conserving water and focusing on, you know, how to make sure we can stretch our resources that we have further, but also looking at how to recommission and actually recommissioning a desalination plant that was basically mothballed about 25 years ago. And now that plant is going to be up and running this fall, just when we need the water the most. We are just about out of all of our other water sources, so this is going to be a tremendous boost. El Nino has not produced the rain that one has hoped to date, and you know, and droughts are cyclical. So what we can do to ensure a safe and reliable local water supply on a long-term basis is a big part of what we've been doing. And it's and they're tough choices to make, and you know, it has impacts on the ratepayers, it has impacts on your budgeting, and to be able to do that with a unanimous vote from a council that has very different political beliefs on a lot of issues to come together and work on this and get it done has really been quite rewarding as mayor.
That's impressive, and I you know, we're all concerned about the drought there in California, in particular where we get so many of our crops and food from there. So, and we'd love to send you some of the rain we're having here now.
Seriously, it's a little off throughout the country, right? So climate change is happening. And I think the other thing our city's been able to do is look at resiliency and focus on what can we do on a day-to-day basis to be as energy efficient as we can, to reduce the level of greenhouse gases wherever we can, to promote good practices not only amongst our own staff and buildings but throughout the city itself. You know, the Santa Barbara is known as the birthplace of the modern environmental movement after the 1969 oil spill, and we want to continue being a leader in sustainability, in resource management, and in protection of our natural resources. And so part of what I've been able to do working with my colleagues is looking at every single way that we get things done, and not only we talked about a gendered lens, there's also a sustainability component to everything we do, and how everything from purchasing your fleet vehicles and buying electric vehicles to using not using pesticides in your park management plan and everything in between. What can we do to really reduce our environmental impact?
You know, that's tremendous that you're making progress on those areas as well. And I'm wondering, given all that you've been able to accomplish as a mayor, why do you think we have so few women mayors? It's only about 17% of the mayors nationally with the city's 30,000 people or more are women. Why do you think there's so few women who actually run for mayor and serve?
Well, I think, you know, success breeds success. I think when you see more women in public office and running, that's going to encourage others to take the plunge. It is not easy to make the decision to run for office. And, you know, I've certainly had some great support moving forward, both but it doesn't, you know, you really have to make the decision to make it happen. And I think women have different family obligations, and they want to be able to see how can that work for them in terms of meeting both their personal and their political needs. And, you know, it can be tough when you're running for an executive position and wanting to focus on getting your message out and not be, you know, politics can not be a fun thing once in a while. And so you need that backing. And I think that, traditionally, a lot of times there's other, you know, people and traditionally who would say, I'm going to run just because. And women generally have been saying that when they want to be asked. And so sometimes you just got to go for it and the support will follow you. And as long as you are true to yourself and true to the positions that you're in, I think you will get the need. But you got to never make it up that. And I think it's up to us as women in elected office to really help other women in elective office while they're there and encourage other women to really run. And that's really something I'm really interested in doing currently and into the future, especially if I make it into Congress.
Right. Well, explain that to us. You've done so much as mayor. What inspired you to run for Congress?
You know, there's so much I've found as mayor that there's so much you can do locally, and so much of it has to do with what federal policies and federal funding either can help or harm local government. And learning from other mayors about getting things done and using those best practices and bringing that approach to Congress is really very important and drives me into running. Plus, you know, as mentioned, I worked at Planned Parenthood, issues related to women's reproductive freedom, the war on women that we're seeing on a national level, I think is something that needs to be addressed and addressed strongly, and I hope to be, for my constituents, not only a strong vote on issues, but also a strong voice moving forward and really raising the things that we're seeing here in California that have worked very well on the environment, on gender equity, on gun violence prevention, move those conversations onto a national stage. And that's what drives me to run, in particular for this office, in that it's to be part of the congressional delegation from California and saying these are the kind of things we know are working here in this state that we need to elevate onto a national level.
Well, that's tremendous. And well, I hope you get in. When's the election for the U.S. House?
So in California, we have it's the primary is June 7th. It's an open primary, meaning it's the top two who get the runoff in November. And I encourage anyone interested to please check out my website at HeleneSchneider.org, or you can follow me on Twitter at Mayor Helene, or on my Facebook page. There's a lot of information there. We have a great chance moving forward. It's really getting to the point where we're connecting with voters, and they're going to people who vote by mail are going to have their ballots in a little over 2 months, and we'll know June 7th.
Well, you've done a great job as mayor, and I hope you make it into Congress. We sure need you there. And that's all the time we have for this segment. Mayor Helene Schneider, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Eleanor. It was a pleasure, and thank you for what you do.
Next up is Ralph Nader. Corporations have huge influence in our government, which they use to gain tax breaks, government subsidies, and policies that favor their companies. Corporate influence distorts every area of government, from energy to the food we eat and the air we breathe. How can we stop the growing power of corporations? Will the left and right join together and take back our government for we the people? Here to address this vital issue is Ralph Nader, the nation's leading consumer crusader and public defender. Mr. Nader first made headlines in 1965 with his book, Unsafe at Any Speed, a scathing indictment of the auto industry for producing unsafe vehicles that led to the passage of auto safety laws. Nader went on to champion major federal consumer protection laws, from motor vehicle safety to the Safe Drinking Water Act, and help launch federal agencies such as OSHA and the Environmental Protection Agency. Ralph Nader has founded numerous organizations such as Public Citizen and inspired legions of consumer advocates, citizen activists, and public interest lawyers who in turn have established their own organizations throughout the country. His national network of citizen groups have had a major impact in areas ranging from tax reform to nuclear energy to health and safety. Nader has dedicated his life to empowering people to create a government responsive to citizens' needs so we can have a better society. Today, Nader focuses on the growing power of multinational corporations and the dangerous convergence of corporate and government power. His most recent book is Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Ralph Nader, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you very much.
Your recent book, Unstoppable, I think is your best work yet, and it examines the possibility of a left-right alliance to take on the corporate state. How would you summarize the core argument of your book?
Well, the argument is that left-right sense that corporations are dominating our entire political economy in ways that spell dictatorial power and over-commercialization of our cultural and spiritual life. So what we're seeing here is a common recognition by left-right that government has been turned into a guarantor of corporate misbehavior and speculation, such as Wall Street, a guarantor. And that comes from corporations swarming over Washington, putting their people in top government positions, funding all kinds of candidates or incumbents, and turning Washington into a servant of Wall Street, otherwise known as the corporate state. The left calls it corporate welfare, and the right calls it crony capitalism. Under that umbrella of convergence between left and right are a lot of issues, some quite surprising. For example, operationally now, there is a left-right convergence behind restoring the minimum wage, at least to what it was in 1968, adjusted for inflation, which would take it from a federal level of $7.25 to $10.92 now. There may be quibbling around the edges, but when you come in 70-80% in the polls supporting a restored minimum wage, that includes a lot of conservative workers in Walmart and elsewhere. But on other issues, there's a convergence. There's a growing convergence against what I call bailout capitalism. That is, if you're too big, then you're too big to fail. Then you collapse on the back of the taxpayers who bail you out, the very people who are the workers and consumers and investors who have been gouged, fleeced, and shattered by your speculation in the first place. There's also a growing left-right against empire and foreign wars of aggression that are boomeranging on us. And that partly is because the right sees it as a huge waste of taxpayer money and unconstitutionally non-authorized. You know, it's they're constitutionally compliant people. They think that only Congress can declare war, and that's what's in the Constitution, not the president. And on the left, it's the repression of people around the world, civilians, people who want to challenge their own dictatorships that are propped up by U.S. military and diplomatic and economic cover. So those are three big areas, but there are a lot of other areas as well. I think Patriot Act is coming up for renewal next year. And in the prior two times when this anti-civil libertarian law that came out of the panic after 9/11 with no hearings pushed through by Bush and Cheney, the renewal in the two prior times were just rubber stamps. They didn't even have a discussion in the Senate and the House worthy of the name. Now I think maybe there'll be some opposition to renewing some of its provisions, such as snooping on your library borrowings or being able to sneak and peek, that is, search your home and not tell you for 72 hours. We can see left-right converging at the state level on juvenile justice reform, on the war on drugs. We see it at the state level successfully in juvenile justice. 15 states have already passed it. That couldn't have happened without conservative and liberal legislators. And after the Supreme Court decision on eminent domain that said New London could take an entire neighborhood and give it to Pfizer, about 24 states passed laws saying not in these states. You're not going to take private property and give it to corporate property. Taking private property is only for public uses like roads and bridges and tunnels and schools, etc. So that's the thrust of my book, Unstoppable, the Emerging Left-Right Coalition Alliance, rather, to dismantle the corporate state. It's important. It's not just a coalition to achieve anything. It's to dismantle the corporate state and its takeover of our government, a lot of our culture, the commercialization of childhood with bad stuff being sold, little kids undermining and bypassing parental authority. That's a big one, too. So I think it's already out there in the minds of people who call themselves conservatives and liberals. The challenge is to turn it operational. Some of it is already operational. We won the Whistleblower Protection Act last year against corporate lobbyists, giving federal employees rights to blow the whistle on corporate fraud on government programs like Medicare and military contracts. Some of it is just beginning to congeal, beginning to get media attention, like the juvenile justice issues. And some of it is still in the minds of tens of millions of conservative, liberal, Republican, Democrat Americans. It hasn't yet gone operational. But I have a chapter on how to fund it. I have a chapter not sugarcoating the whole issue, taking one obstacle after another, discussing it, and showing how it can be overcome. So I think it's an exciting book. It's designed to be read by people who are readers and are serious about this country, its future, its role in the world.
Yes, I think you have written the most exciting and important book of the generation, Unstoppable, and I hope all our listeners will read it. You have been a leading activist since the 1960s, and there were some left-right coalitions then. What's the biggest success you have had personally with a left-right coalition?
Well, I think it's been numerous successes. We stopped things like the Clinch River Breeder Reactor in 1983 that General Electric, Westinghouse, Ronald Reagan, and Senator Howard Baker from Tennessee, that's where the plant was going to be. It was a huge boondoggle. It was a stunning upset, 56-40, in the Senate because of a left-right coalition in Washington. We should remember that the auto safety law passed almost unanimously in the Congress in 1966, and that certainly dismantled the power of the auto companies to decide what level of hazard or safety you were going to have to buy when you purchased a car. The 1986 False Claims Act, that's returned tens of billions of dollars from fraudulent contracting with the federal government to the taxpayer. And that was a left-right as well. That was between Senator Grassley, Republican of Iowa, and Congressman Howard Berman, Democrat from California. They got together and they beat the corporate lobbies. This last year, there was a left-right upsurge in defiance of their leadership in the House of Representatives. They defied John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi, just missed by 12 votes, banning NSA dragnet snooping on all Americans. And they blocked, the left-right alliance did block the plunge to war in Syria last year. That's up for renewal, obviously. So I think you see it happening in not just in legislatures. You see it happening in the kind of cultural revulsion to the exploitation of children by corporations, junk food, junk drink, obesity, diabetes, just sweeping aside parental authority, direct marketing to 8, 7, 6, 5-year-olds. I think that's a big one that's coming up. There is a left-right alliance in the courtrooms to have more ballot access for third-party candidates. For example, the Libertarian Party and the Green Party have teamed up, not just in the courtroom, but to also lobby state legislatures to loosen up a bit and let the voters get more choices and more issues and more agenda instead of just being confronted with increasingly similar Democrat and Republican parties dialing for the same commercial dollars. I think there's a left-right alliance going back years for the initiative referendum recall type of government at the state level. And, of course, the opposition to the big banks that are too big to fail and the desire to break them up, that comes in about 90% in the polls, as well as prosecuting Wall Street crooks who got away with it in 2008.
Right. So you've mentioned, you know, some of the emerging left-right coalitions there. Where do you see the biggest energy? Do you think, is it kind of geographically some area in the country? Is it local? Is it national? Or where's the biggest energy coming from for the left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state?
It's scattered, actually. I can't locate it. Okay. For example, the Koch brothers are lobbying southern legislators to put a surcharge tax on solar panels, because now solar panels are being applied to roofs everywhere, and they're challenging the Koch brothers' gas and oil interests. Well, they're not winning, And that's because, you know, you have Republicans and Democrats say, what? I mean, you know, we want solar panels. We don't want them burdened by taxation. The way the oil and gas industry has been coddled by the federal government with all kinds of tax breaks and loopholes and subsidies. So there it is, right in the conservative South. So it depends on the issue. I do want to see it go really big time, because I don't see any other political realignment likely emerging in the next 12 years that actually gets things done for the American people, other than a left-right alliance. So I'll take it wherever it comes up. But I do urge some enlightened billionaires to begin funding citizen advocacy groups that only focus on convergent issues. That is, they don't have any other agenda. They're not fighting left-right. They only go to work every day to push this left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state, project by project.
Right. I think you put your finger on the key challenge in our country right now, because no matter what issue you might be concerned about, whether it's wanting more renewable energy and less of the fossil fuels, or, you know, changes in health care, or whatever it is you're looking for, the influence of the corporations is so profound in Washington, D.C., that it's distorting every area of policy. So we must address this, and you're so right that left and right see it. It's just, as you say in your book rightly, there's no one who that's what their job is, to focus on building these left-right coalitions. So you call for creating several institutions, but basically having an institutional base for this kind of convergence work, that with an organization or organizations that would have staying power. Have you had much response to that critical idea, and are you working with any group to found such an institution?
Well, we're looking for some rich people to fund it. Foundations aren't likely to. They don't like this issue. They're usually either left or right. Foundations are liberal and conservative. So we're looking for individually wealthy people who have a sense that their country's going the wrong way and that they're not going to hand it in very good shape to their children and grandchildren. So there's a tiny percent of the many billionaires that are around these days, especially as they grow older and, you know, have a different take on what they want to leave behind other than a pile of gold. That's what we're looking for. And it doesn't take that much. I mean, when you see what the Koch brothers have funded in terms of think tanks, or Mr. Skay for the Mellon interest, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, it really doesn't take that much. So if anybody has any leads, we're all ears. But it's going to go on anyway. I think the most exciting on the ground is the support for community-rooted businesses, credit unions, community banks, farmer-to-consumer markets, local renewable energy, community health clinics that focus on prevention. Every time we spend our money, our consumer dollars, with these entities, we're taking away money from Bank of America, Pfizer, big hospital chains, agribusiness. That's called the displacement movement, and that really is conservative liberal. I mean, you don't find conservatives refusing to go to farmer markets because they want to patronize some giant supermarket chain.
Right, and that leads right into my next question, is what about our listeners? You know, what can we do? You know, we're feeling kind of overwhelmed by the power of these corporations, the Koch brothers, the billions that are being spent to, you know, advance the interests of the corporations over the people, in spite of broad support among the people for various policies and so forth. We keep losing in Washington, so what are the top things that are, like, the top three things that our listeners could do to deal with this whole thing and support the left-right alliance to dismantle the corporate state?
Well, one, you can get a victory next year, because when President Obama sends the Pacific Trade Agreement to Congress, I think right now we have a majority in the House to block it of left-right, in defiance, by the way, of John Boehner and Nancy Pelosi, their leaders. However, you know, the lobbyists will try to spin off some of these. So if you want to tie what I'm going to recommend now to a victory, to begin the first rollback of these corporate-managed globalized trade agreements that have sucked so many jobs and industries out of our country to dictatorial regimes abroad. What you can do is find someone who is opposite you. You know, if you're a Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, find your opposite and print a letterhead. You can give it a nice title. You can say the Left-Right Alliance in the 21st Congressional District of New York, and then send and then get a few people also on the letterhead, and then send the first letter to your representative and your two senators. And you can use some of the arguments in this book. You can pick the issues, and then you start increasing your civic skills and how to write a powerful letter and how to bring it to the attention of the member when they come back into your area for trying to ask for your vote. So it's like a little club. It's a lot of fun. You'll meet people you haven't met before. You might help each other get more enlightened on your issues, and you will see the magic of a left-right confrontation with your member of Congress. They really turn pale when they see a left-right coming in at them, because they can't manipulate left against right or right against left, because they can't go the easy way, because they're in a red state. You know, they just pander to the right, or in a blue state to the left, and get campaign contributions accordingly. It sort of perplexes them. I've seen that happen on Capitol Hill. When a staffer says to a senator in the morning, we're getting a huge number of emails, and the senator says, "Ah, from our supporters, eh?" And the staffer says, "No, it's coming in left, right." You can't believe the impact. So everything starts with a couple people. Everything starts with a conversation. And now you can start with a letterhead and actually focus it on blocking the Pacific Trade Agreement, because you can get all the information you need by going to globaltradewatch.org, globaltradewatch.org. That's one of our groups, and it lays out all the issues, the arguments. You have a lot of fun. It's fun to build power. It's not fun to have to swallow your grievances and go through life feeling that you don't matter and you don't count. Start the letterhead group.
That sounds great. And then in terms of establishing an institution that focuses on convergence with left and right on this set of issues, you mention in the book that we would start that by maybe spinning off staff and resources from an existing organization and create a new organization where convergence is the only mission. Do you know any specific organizations that you think would be kind of a starting point for that kind of a spinoff?
Yeah, I think ours would offer, you know, the idea is to get like 10 organizations donating one full-time person around a explicit converging agenda, so they know what they're getting into. And that's possible. You know, Heritage is quite wealthy, Cato, Public Citizen, I could put one in. There'd be others, people for the American Way. And let's say they all decide they're going to work on five issues, like civil liberties, like corporate welfare and bailouts, like prison reform, maybe anti-war, whatever they all agree on. and that will get it underway.
I think that sounds great. And have any of those conversations started to happen among those organizations?
Well, I've gone over to Cato for a very good session. It was very successful. I want to do it in Heritage before I put the question to them. I've asked Grover Norquist. He could do it. He says he's going to think about it, because I was with him at a National Press Club function a few days ago that was relayed on radio around the country. Mm-hmm. So I think it might happen. Remember, these are the groups that have other priorities that are funded that animate them day by day, and they're mm-hmm. usually the priorities of conflict, that is, against one another, not the priorities of convergence. For example, the priorities of conflict would be Heritage and Cato would be against regulating further the coal industry or the nuclear industry, and the liberal side would be for it. So you see, that's the only thing restraining them. It isn't lack of money. So we'll try it. That's why I'm looking for an independent-minded, enlightened billionaire or two.
Right. Well, if we had one, it would get us going. And you write in the book a letter to a billionaire saying exactly what you want to do and where the money would go. So the hunt is on. Is there any other way you see it being funded besides the, a billionaire, or maybe start with some more modest funding and hopefully attract a billionaire into the game?
It could start with just two people. Each side donates one funds for a full-time staff and start with two people.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they all agree on is that the Pentagon budget is unauditable. Every year, the Government Accountability Office of the U.S. Congress, which is the auditing office of government agencies in the executive branch, has to report that the Pentagon does not provide them with the data that would allow them to be audited. And the Pentagon admits this. They don't even know how these dollars are being spent with any precision. So every few years, the Pentagon says, we'll do it. The latest postponement is 2017. We'll get it by 2017. Well, that probably comes in close to 100% left, right. I mean, half of the federal discretionary budget, apart from Medicare and Medicaid, but half of all the departments and agencies' budget is Pentagon. And there's no major enemy. There's no Soviet Union, that requires heavy-duty systems of weapon destruction and all. And so I think that would really come in. I like that one. And, of course, when you do that, you discover all kinds of waste and corruption, and you can strain tens of billions of dollars out of this $800 billion monster to apply to repairing America at communities all over the country, creating good-paying jobs that can't be exported.
And just so our listeners know, in your book, Unstoppable, you actually name 25 specific areas that the left and right could work on together, and you've mentioned several of them here. Auditing the Pentagon would be a huge one. Getting tough on the corporate crime, checking out just where are all these corporate bonanza bailouts and subsidies and tax breaks, kind of what are they, and stop it. So there's a roster. You've kind of laid out the agenda. That's a good starting point. If we get some folks together, have the conversation across left, right, and just let's pick, one, two, or three of those to start working on.
Yes. I think another big one is giving investors more power over the company executives that they whose company they own. I mean, the people who own these giant corporations have no power over the people who run them, whose huge bonuses and salaries they're forced to pay. So people left, right are really angry about these gigantic executive salaries that they're giving to themselves with their rubber stamp board of directors. That's a good one for convergence.
Right, and of the issues that you map out there, you're looking at things that have maybe 60, 70, 80%, maybe more of Americans would support that program. So
yeah, that's
it's
right.
It's amazing that we live in a so-called democracy, but issues that have that much support are not moving through Congress, or if they are, they're going in an opposite direction.
Yeah, that's the strategy of the ruling powers, of the plutocracy or oligarch. They want to divide and rule. There's nothing new about that. It's been going on for over 2,000 years. The way you deal with the people is to divide them and pit them against one another on issues they really disagree about, and not at all focus on the very important issues that they do agree about. So left-right disagrees on reproductive rights, gun control, constitutionally required balanced budget, school prayer. We know all that.
Mm-hmm.
And the powers love to focus on that. But they know what happens when the people throw off the chains and say, we're going to focus on right down on Main Street and take on Wall Street. We're going to focus on things that we agree on that can make a better life for everyone. We're up against another convergence, the convergence of the corporate Democrats represented by the Clintons, who are corporatists and militarists, Hillary the Hawk, and the corporate Republicans like John Boehner and Senator McConnell and Senator Graham and so forth. They all work together. They push through crony capitalism. They pushed through wars of empire. They pushed through tax breaks for the giant corporations and their super wealthy patrons. So that's what we have to break apart. But, you know, they have a lot of money and power, but we have the votes. The Left-Right Alliance has the votes. It's just it has to go operational around redirections for our country.
Right, absolutely. And you mentioned Grover Norquist. I'm curious what he thinks of Unstoppable.
He likes it. He gave a blurb for the back of the book. And I'm going to start with him. I think he's a likely person, and he's got a lot of baggage, of course. He's against unions, and he's against taxes on corporations and individuals. On the other hand, he's against empire, and he's against corporate welfare or crony capitalism, and he's very strong on civil liberties. So, I mean, those are pretty good starts, I must say. And I don't think he likes the Federal Reserve running amok either. So those are good starts.
Fantastic. Well, I so appreciate what you're doing, and your book really is kind of a blueprint and lays out, you know we've got corporate government convergence in favor of the corporations. We can confront that and change that with a convergence among left and right on issues and approaches that can help the majority of the American people and help our country move forward. So
That's right. Thank you so much. If they want an autographed copy, they can just go to nader.org. And see how you can get an autographed copy of the book if you want to give it to a student or a relative as a gift. Anything to get discussions going. Everything starts with conversation.
Absolutely. I encourage all our listeners to get the book, Unstoppable. Read it. Get a group together in your neighborhood. Get your friends together. Read it and talk about it and see what you can do and how you can be part of taking back America.
And you can sign up for my free weekly column by going to the same website, nader.org. Thank you.
Fantastic. That's all the time we have. Ralph Nader, thank you so much for coming on All Together Now.
You're welcome. Thank you for your good program and your listeners.
Thank you, Ralph Nader, for joining All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. See you next week.